Well, hello again and welcome to another edition of Authors Audio. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. Remember, you can listen to all our interviews by going to our website at worldwideweb.authorsaudio.com and click on the Archive Interviews section. Today we're going to be speaking with Dr. Lynn Marzulli about his new book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. Following his three previous books about the Nephilim, a race of hybrid humans, Lynn talks in depth about these giants mentioned in Genesis 6, and how they may be in fact returning, and why we are witnessing so many UFO sightings these days. Dr. Lynn Marzulli lives in Malibu, California with his wife and two daughters. He is also a musician and composer and has recorded a number of albums. His in-depth research of UFO cults has become the basis for his Nephilim series of novels. And now I'm very happy to welcome to the program Dr. Lynn Marzulli. How are you doing today, Lynn?
Thanks for having me here, Jake. It is a pleasure.
Well, Lynn, it's a real pleasure to have you here on Authors Audio to talk about your new book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. And this book takes in quite a large time frame from Genesis 6 right up to the present time. And in Genesis 6, the Bible talks about Luciferian fallen angels who came to the earth and started to have progeny with the women of the earth, who basically produce giants somewhere between 10 and 25 feet tall, we suppose, and that these giants were around until the flood of Noah about 400 years later. And if we fast forward to our time now, what you're saying is also that the UFO activity has really increased since after the war, but certainly was throughout history as well. But now people are seeing literally thousands of sightings a year. And in your book, you're basically saying that these may not be the friendly little critters from other planets dropping in to say hello. These may be, in fact, the Luciferian fallen angels coming back to really take over the earth and to take over mankind itself. And if this is the case, then this presents a very scary thing indeed. And I think that's sort of the central theme of your book. Am I correct?
That is a thumbnail sketch of what the paradigm is behind the book and my belief system. Yes, I feel that this is what we're going to see. This is what we have been seeing. In fact, in my newsletter, plug, there's an interview that I did with a former contactee, very interesting, and she's a born-again Christian now, and she says unequivocally that these beings that were telepathically communicating with her were, of course, demons. At the time, she didn't realize it, but as she got more involved in it, she realized what it was that was behind this thing, and then she got terrified. When you look at how the modern abduction phenomena parallels what is written in the ancient scriptures, specifically Genesis 6, and of course the Book of Enoch, which is not part of the canon, but we can at least appreciate its historicity and look at it in regard as a history book. But when you look at Genesis 6, the account of the sons of God coming to earth, taking from them whoever they wanted to as wives, procreating with them, and the offspring then is the Nephilim. And that is essentially what is going on today. Dr. Jacobs, who, again, is in this month's newsletter, I did an extensive interview with the man. He's been involved in the abduction phenomena for almost, I think, close to four decades now. And he thinks it's very nefarious, very dark. He thinks that there is definitely a breeding program, that there is an agenda, and they don't have our interest in it at all. He has a different worldview than I do, is operating under a different paradigm than I am. So we have a sort of a disparity in our views, but we both agree that they are, he won't maybe go as far to use the word as malevolent, which I use frequently in regard to these so-called alien beings. He feels that they are, however, that the agenda is dark and not friendly towards us. So in a nutshell, yes, I think that this is the coming great deception that is spoken about in ancient manuscripts, and we are witnessing it beginning to unravel in different media in the last 2 or 3 months. I've never seen anything like it, starting from the Vatican press release to the Stevensville major UFO flap. A thumbnail sketch for your listeners, the Vatican press release basically is by Funes, who the Vatican chief astrologer, who basically came up, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said that E.T. is our brother and we should embrace him.
You're saying the Vatican said that?
The Vatican said that, correct. So then on the heels of that, you had the Stevensville UFO flap, which actually happened back in January, but it finally got legs, the story got legs, and different media began to carry it. For instance, the Drudge Report, Fox News, and just different websites had reports of the Stevensville UFO flap, and quite a hubbub over that. And of course, Larry King had witnesses on his show, a panel of witnesses, not only in Stevensville, but the likes of George Norrie, Stanton Friedman, and several other people. And the panel was quite extraordinary. And at one point, he actually had two of the Phoenixville Lights witnesses. And of course, he has to have a skeptic on who doesn't believe it, no matter what is there, and how much evidence, the guy just won't believe it until it's hovering outside his window. So you go from a Larry King interview and the Stevensville flap and the Vatican to four Air Force, retired Air Force gentlemen were on Larry King about 2 weeks ago now, and they all had served with the Air Force in the capacity of the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile System, in other words, the silos in different parts of the United States where the missiles are kept at ready launch, which is essentially a green light. Yeah, and they went on record stating that a UFO buzzed the base, and when that happened, it knocked offline 10 missiles simultaneously. What I found of great interest was one of the technicians that was on the show stated, to the best of his knowledge, that event was unprecedented. In other words, they would see one or two missiles go offline, but certainly never 10, and never 10 all at once. So this was an anomaly, as it were, and all four of these gentlemen came on the record and basically stated that the government has been systematically covering it up in a variety of ways. Certainly one is to discredit anybody who sees this, heap tons of ridicule on them, and also threaten them, as many of the Roswell witnesses said that they were literally threatened from this. And then, of course, last week is the fourth one that I've been traveling with, is Edgar Mitchell. And there are those who say that, well, you know, Mitchell's full of hot air. I don't believe anything the man tells me. He's, you know, the Noetic Institute, and they make all these excuses. And yet the guy's on radio. This story was picked up in major, pretty much all the media carried it last week. I wrote several blogs about it and continue to discuss it. And he basically said unequivocally, let me get my notes here, unequivocally that we had been visited by UFOs, that the extraterrestrial presence was real, that the events of Roswell really happened, that the governments of the world have been systematically covering up the phenomena, that the cover-up began after World War II, right after Roswell. They are moving towards disclosure. He cited the release of the UFO files from Belgium, France, Mexico, and the UK have opened their files. He also cited the new Vatican release, which I mentioned earlier. He also cited that people will accept the fact that there are UFOs in the skies, and when this happened, it will be almost like a ho-hum attitude. Well, we've always known they were there, so now that they're here, it's kind of acceptance. It's funny, I wrote in my blog yesterday that, and we've seen this quote before, I'm sure, that truth, there are basically three, truth goes through three stages. The first is ridicule, when someone comes up with a new idea. They're ridiculed by Columbus. The world isn't flat, it's round. I mean, the man met tons of ridicule. And then, of course, the second is to a violent opposition to the idea, which, of course, what we see with the UFO agenda. Those people, let's say, in the 50s who came forward were ridiculed by the press, by announcers, by officials. Everyone was ridiculed. and which is why many people just kept silence about it. And then we move into the violent opposition. We see the an example of that would be the people from Roswell, who allegedly saw something, were involved in this cover-up, and they were threatened. Their lives were threatened. People have gone on the record now, years later, decades later, saying that Army types showed up at their house, told them that they didn't see what they thought they had seen, that it was a national security issue, and they were to remain silent. The desert was a big place. They could dispose of that whole, your whole family, and no one would ever know the better of it. And then, of course, the third part of the process of accepting a new truth is a almost a, like Mr. Mitchell has said, that it's almost, it's after the fact. It's, well, we always knew this. This has always been the way it is. And this truth is self-evident. We've always believed this. And that's where we're moving. We've gone from, and just in my own little life, I've seen it. When I began investigating in 1990, now going almost 20 years ago, in the latter part of the 80s, early 90s, this was really fringe stuff. You just did not talk about this kind of stuff at all, certainly not in church circles. And I was very careful who I began to tell what I was getting involved with, the books I was reading, the research I was doing.
Yes, Lynn, I'd be interested in your connectivity between the ancient scriptures in Genesis 6 and so on, all over the Bible, and what's happening in the modern day times, where we're able to have video cameras and so on, and actually record some of these sightings that have been seen all over the world. And the interpretation that you're postulating here is that these so-called craft or these aliens are actually the returning beings from those ancient days that the Bible refers to. A lot of people think they're reverse engineered craft from the military and so on, but I don't know about that either.
Well, I think Fife Symington is a good example, the former governor of Arizona. We see a major flip-flop, not that politicians don't do that habitually anyway, with all due respect, but we see Fife Symington coming on board when the Phoenix Light happened in the 90s. During the press conference, and by the way, I saw the press conference on television, they make fun of this whole thing about the people saw anything, and it was military flares and, you know, cargo planes or what have you. In fact, they had someone dressed up like a little gray alien come running onto the stage, and everyone yucked it up, and it was kind of humorous. Well, over a decade later now, Fife is on the Larry King show. That's, in fact, he was on that same panel that I spoke to you about earlier regarding the Stevensville UFO flap. And the first thing Fife Symington said when it was his turn to speak, when he got on the microphone, the very first words out of his mouth was that he apologized to his conformist constituents in Arizona for treating the subject so lightly. He then elaborated, saying that he was there in Phoenix at the time of the event, and what he saw was a craft not of this world. Now, that's a guy who's in, you know, directly involved with the government, in at least on some level, in place. He had power at one time. And he could have easily just have said, well, perhaps it might have been some sort of a, you know, military craft. No, he said, whatever he saw was not of this world. So it's kind of interesting that he came out.
That's right. And, of course, you have a lot of people saying that this is reverse technology for the U.S. military.
Well, I mean, it's, people have alluded to that. Certainly those of the yoke of, let's say, Bob Lazar have alluded to that. Stanton Friedman believes that it would be, and I'll use his analogy, for us to back engineer something like this would be similar or akin to taking one of our nuclear submarines and dropping it off in Christopher Columbus's hands in 1492 and go, here you go, Chris, have at it, make one. He wouldn't have a clue, wouldn't even know where to begin.
Well, I'm sure he might have got the plans upside down for sure. Lynn, I'd like to get into the real crux of your book and talk about the period of time that you go into quite detail in your book, And that is the area in Genesis 6 where apparently 200 fallen angels came down to the earth and basically started to mate with the women of the human women of the planet. And they created a strange progeny of giants that we call the Nephilim. And I've always kind of wondered, after many thoughts and discussions about this, if God is all-powerful and certainly more powerful than even the angels, why would a loving God allow such a terrible thing to happen to his human creations, number one? And number two is, does that really mean that we're sort of on our own to fend for ourselves, that God's just, kind of testing us this way, or is there kind of another explanation, do you think, for that?
Let me address the second one first, the second part of the question. We are not alone, as the Gospels tell us, and when I say the Gospels, I'm including the four Gospels, but also the good news of the other epistles that are all enjoined together to make the whole council, and it basically says that we fight not, let's say, in the flesh. In other words, beings that are in the flesh, but we fight principalities and rulers that are invisible, of invisible realms that are here, that have authority in certain places, and that's who we are fighting. But it also gives us weapons in which to fight and how to fight. So we're not really left all alone. I believe that certainly you could go into one of the scriptures or one of the stories, and you could look at the book of Daniel, one of my favorites, when he is visited by an angel. But he's already set out a prayer, a specific request, and several weeks go by and nothing happens. Finally, the angel shows up and goes, "Hey, the moment you said your request, I was dispatched, but I ran into warfare. In other words, I couldn't get here. The prince of Persia fought against me. I had to go back and get help and reinforcements and then try, and so here I am." Now, that gives us a glimpse into the heavenlies that we don't get anywhere else, really. We get another alluded to in the book of Revelation where it says specifically Michael, who, by the way, is that same angel that the angel who was appearing to Daniel says, "I got help from. I got help, and guess what? Michael came with, a couple of his boys or, a couple of dozen, a legion. I don't know. It doesn't say. I wish the text was more specific, but it doesn't tell us how many came and fought. And then we see in the book of Revelation, Michael wars against Satan and his angels, plural. So, there's a war in heaven. I mean, it talks about a war in heaven. So this goes back into your first question. Why the war now? Why wait eons to have the war now? Why not take care of this, way up front? What's the deal here?
Right.
Why, when the fallen angels come down, why does he wait 400 years before he sends judgment? I mean, these are questions that I have, just like you have. I don't get it. I don't understand it. I'm the same question you would ask yourself: why allow the Holocaust? If you know this is going to happen, why allow 6 million people to be, killed and bodies burned in ovens? I mean, you could make a case from the Holocaust, the birth of Israel happened, which is true, but I mean, surely there must be a better way to do this. So, I have deep questions in this area myself.
Okay, so getting back to the story, we have these fallen angels, perhaps 200 fallen angels, who have decided to come down to Earth, and they see our beautiful women down here, and they decide to procreate. And the progeny of this procreation are a group of beings called the Nephilim, and these are giants on the earth now. These are strange-looking giants, maybe anywhere from, 10 to 15, 20 feet tall. I guess we don't know exactly how tall they are. This is a pretty amazing time period for the planet.
Well, and I don't, you know, I can't verify the height, but my theory is simply this, that apparently we have, once again from scriptures, we have this character. This is post-flood now, after the second incursion. So it's literally thousands of years from the first incursion where the 200 angels come down on Mount Hermon and to the second incursion when they come again. And we see these fallen angels doing the same nonsense in and around, let's say, the land of Canaan, the Promised Land. Interestingly enough, that's where they show up. And we have this colorful figure by the name of Og, O-G, Og, the king of Bashan. And Og might have been as tall as 15 feet. We also know that Goliath was certainly a Nephilim, six fingers, six toes on each of his hands, which is one of the effects of these beings. And conservative height would be 9 feet, but many people think 12 to 15 feet tall. This is the second incursion. My point is this: what if the first incursion was the strongest? What if these angels, these fallen angels, lose or are in the act literally of losing some of their power? Not all of it, but some of it, as time progresses. It's just a theory. So the first time that they came, they were the most potent. And this is what the Nephilim at this time, let's say conservative 20 feet tall to go the other side of the spectrum, 30 feet. So you got 20 to 30 foot tall giant. When you see, and this is what amazes me, you get the brightest minds on the planet and they go to, let's say, someplace like Baalbek. And I talk about this extensively in Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, that Baalbek really defies pretty much the whole idea of sweaty slaves and rolling stones on logs with, you know, ropes and all this other nonsense. There are the three largest hewn stones on the planet called the Trilithon at the base of the temple, which, by the way, was used by the Greeks, Romans, and of course, these three stones predate that. So other civilizations came and built other temples on these three great rocks called the Trilithon. What's even more enigmatic, Jake, is the fact that it begs the question, one, how did they get these stones from the quarry a quarter mile away? And two, the largest hand-hewn rock ever quarried by man is a quarter mile away in the quarry, and it's left still partially buried in the earth, partially not quarried out. And the thing is just, it's like 70 feet long. It's just ridiculous. I mean, you can go online and hit Baalbek, and they always show that stone. I mean, we have cranes today that cannot move it. We do not have cranes today to move it. We would be hard-pressed to lay those three stones the way they're laid in the Trilithon. And this is like, you know, how do these guys do this thing? Well, my theory, which, again, ties back into the biblical account, is simply this, that the first incursion, these beings could have been 20 to 30 feet tall. The moment you figure that in, the moment you cross that line and go, let's just say for the sake of argument, let's take a conservative number. Let's say 20 feet tall. You've got a being that's 20 feet tall. What can he lift? And if you've got a couple hundred of these guys running around, all of a sudden it makes sense. Oh, that's how they moved him. Same thing with the pyramid.
Yes, well, that's right. I mean, if you can scoot around in your UFOs, you could get to South America very quickly, or Egypt, or wherever. Why they would be building pyramids is another interesting question, if they in fact did that. And also, there's another question that people ask, and that's, of course, if the Nephilim are a production of a human and an angel, there's probably a very remote possibility that they themselves could produce progeny. What do you think about that?
Sort of like a mule, and that's my take. I don't think they were able to reproduce. It certainly would, and when you look at the legends, let's say, of Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god, and Kukulkan, this white-skinned man who, you know, taught certain technology. When you look at the polygonal structures of, let's say, Machu Picchu and other sites throughout Mesoamerica. It once again, it begs the question, how did these people not only get the rocks, these blocks up from the valley floor to the top of where Machu Picchu is built, but how the heck did they construct these temples, and how did they carve the stone like this? I mean, no one has been able to solve the riddle.
Well, this certainly true, Len, that there are many unanswered questions as to how the pyramids anywhere in the world got built, why they were built, and by whom. So I guess we'll have to wait for all the scorecards to come in on that one. But I would like to get back to an area which is really the second word in your book title, and that's the prophecy part of your book, which you quote several scriptures all through the book and maintain a consistency there. So maybe we could talk a little bit about your ideas on that prophecy.
Well, I would certainly agree with that. You mentioned the prophecy of Ezekiel. It's the one I'm constantly referring to. I watch this literally daily, sometimes not every hour, but there's different sites I go to, Debkafile, Stratfor, just to name two. But there's others. Arut Shava. I mean, I'm always looking at what's happening in the Middle East. I check out the Iranian papers, just whatever I can get my hands on, so to speak. What this prophecy, and here's the deal for your listeners who've never looked at this stuff or traveled in it, the reason why I adhere to biblical prophecy, unlike the prophecy of Nostradamus, is simply this. Nostradamus is very obfuscated. And it's done so deliberately because he uses quatrains, four verses, to try to tell you what may happen. And they're very unspecific. There's not a lot of specificity with the prophecies of Nostradamus, and can be interpreted in many ways. Now, skeptics of biblical prophecy will say that exact argument back at me. Well, I say to them, unlike the Nostradamus prophecy, Ezekiel 37, we'll start there, which says that I will gather the Jews from the four corners of the earth and reestablish them in their homeland in the latter days, that they will become a nation in one day. I'm citing several different prophecies here. And what we see is in AD 70, when Titus and the Roman army comes in, and after almost a year of siege, finally breaks the gates down of Jerusalem, killed over 1 million inhabitants of the city. The rest of them go into slavery, destroy the temple. There's a later revolt several decades later, which is brutally crushed. And then that's it. I mean, everything is literally torn down to the point where no one really knows where the old temple was actually located. Some people say, well, the existing Dome of the Rock is built over it. Other people say, who knows? It might not be. It may be a couple hundred yards downwind here where this little structure called the Well of Souls is. I mean, no one knows.
Yes. Well, from what I've heard, they really have everything ready to go right now, and I don't know what location they will choose, but it'll be very interesting because I think it's something that's close on the horizon to starting, yeah.
Well, they are, and of course, this ties back into the prophecies that in the latter days I will regather you from the four corners of the earth, speaking about Israel, reestablishing your ancient homeland, Israel. We also see in Amos 9 that it's very specific here, that once I've done that, you'll never again be kicked out of your land. You'll never again lose the land, ever. So, you've got this from the time of the diaspora in AD 70 to the foundation of Israel in 1948, almost 2,000 years here, you've got. And it's really unprecedented that any culture would be able to last that long. Usually cultures last several generations and then that's it, which is why we don't see any Hittites running around today and the ancient Babylonians no longer exist. The culture, the language becomes extinct and it no longer exists on the planet. Yet the mystery of the Jew is precisely, which is why I believe they are the chosen people, and the prophecy of Ezekiel hinges around them coming back into their homeland. Interestingly enough, just to shore up this argument, that when the Jews were kicked from Milan in AD 70, several anomalies began to happen in and around Israel, ancient Israel. One of them was the latter rain did not fall. So there was not enough rainfall to grow anything. Two, if you were able to succeed somehow to grow something, Israel, from the time of the diaspora until the early part of the 20th century, was plagued by locusts. So, I mean, you'd have these, like, the place would be overrun by locusts. Thirdly, the nation of Israel, the ancient land, was plagued by earthquakes. So you'd go there and you'd build something, and these huge earthquakes would come and wipe everything out, just rock everything. So people did not inhabit the land. So that's why when Mark Twain is over there in the latter part of the 20th century, or 19th century, he's there, and he writes, you know, Bethlehem was like a wasteland. You know, we went for hours and didn't see a living soul. And that's how it was before the climate change, the locusts stopped coming back, the earthquake stopped, and the latter rain began to fall, all at the cusp between the 19th and 20th century. And now we see that Israel is one of the leading exporter of fruit on the planet. It is literally planted over a billion, with a B, a billion trees, and created the ancient forest land which it once had. I mean, this is all prophetic. Well, after Ezekiel 37 comes Ezekiel 38 and 39, and that speaks of a federation of nations which come up against, and here's what I mean by specificity, comes up against a land of unwalled villages. Now, you have to understand something, that in the ancient days, thousands of years ago, specifically 2,500 years ago, when this prophecy was penned, that there was no such thing as a land of unwalled villages. It just didn't exist in the ancient world. The first thing you did if you wanted to construct a city was to build the largest moat, the highest wall. You would fortify everything because you were surrounded by hostile neighbors in other lands who wanted to take your goods, belongings, weapons, women, children as slaves, and anything else they could do, and destroy your way of life. So in order to survive, you did this. Now, people argue with me and say, well, then, you know, the Israelis have border fences and all this stuff. Yeah, they have that. They have security. Fine, I'll grant you that. But nonetheless, it is a land of unwalled villages. It didn't exist in the ancient world. And so I believe, and again, the prophecy is very specific when it says, in the latter days, it uses that phrase several times, in the end of days, latter days, when I have gathered you from the four corners of the earth and set you in your ancient homeland, which is exactly what we see in Ezekiel 37 happening and prophesied otherwhere, other places in the Bible, then it says, this confederacy of nations will come up against you. And it lists the nations. And the second nation, though, the first nation is Russia, which is Magog, Gog and Magog, which many prophecy scholars believe is Russia. And what we see now, which wasn't there 50 years ago, certainly, is a military and economic liaison between Iran and Russia. The Russians are literally supplying the Iranians with much of their weaponry, and certainly their nuclear ambitions are tied directly to the Russians. And so we see some of this prophecy being getting ready to be fulfilled. If you consider Iran, which is the second nation, which is, again, named by name, Persia is the second nation. And we all know, or students of history know, that Persia was called Persia until the latter half of the 20th century, and then it became Iran. When you talk to an expatriated Iranian, they will always, 9 times out of 10, refer to themselves, I'm from Persia, when you ask them where they are. So we see that Ezekiel 38 and 39, which talks about this confederacy of nations coming up against the land of unwalled villages, Israel, is in the news almost every day. We see the saber-rattling of Ahmadinejad saying things to Israel like, Israel is a cancer soon to be irradiated. Israel is a dry weather tree soon to be plucked up by its roots and thrown into the sea. And on and on and on. And we also see the Israelis saber-rattling right back, let's say, to Syria and Damascus, saying, if you use chemical weapons against us, we will annihilate you, which ties into a prophecy of Isaiah 17, which says very succinctly that Damascus is a ruinous heap, no longer is a city. And we know from history that Damascus has never been without a human presence in it. It's one of the longest or the oldest civilized places on the earth.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right, Lynn. I think Damascus is the oldest city, or certainly one of the oldest cities on the planet continuously. Yeah.
So this is what I get into, and I talk about, this is what I believe is we're looking at this. I think it's going to happen very quickly, sooner than a lot of people think, possibly even this year, the way they're going at it. I mean, it's getting really crazy. And it's a time bomb. I'm sorry, what?
Yes, well, are you talking about a war between, let's say, Israel and Iran, or Israel and Lebanon or Syria, or are you talking about the Armageddon style war that we all are familiar with in the Bible?
Well, I think if it's the Ezekiel 38 prophecy, then there's a confederacy of nations, and yeah, that come in into play.
Well, I think you could be very right, Lynn, because of so many factors all coming together at once. First of all, of course, countries like Russia and China have become a lot
Right,
closer.
correct.
They've aligned themselves militarily in many ways and economically in many ways. And I know that Iran has just created its own offshore bourse, which is basically a stock exchange for the trading of oil and gas products like this. They've already got that started. They're already selling gas, I believe. Well, you got to know that as soon as they start selling oil, they're not going to be using US dollars to trade this oil. Right now, there are only two places in the world where you can trade oil through US dollars, and one is in London. I think maybe the other one is in France, probably in Paris. So when Iran starts to do this, it's going to take the US dollar is going to take another great pounding. And among other things, like Iran's nuclear program and so on and so forth, we could be very, very close to this kind of situation happening realistically. You don't have to fantasize too much about it. Kind of scary.
Yeah, I think it's unraveling. I really do. And it's you've got to watch all three things. You have to realize, you're listening, need to understand that Israel and Iran are both on walking a tightrope, and that tightrope is over. Just it's nasty. Israel knows that Iran might get the bomb within 2 to 3 months, 3 to 4 months, let's say 6 months. So they know they've got to act sooner than later. Iran knows. And it has a history of this, or Israel has a history of this, that Israel will do a preemptive strike, just like they did in Iraq. They have a history of it. They know that the Israelis will not allow them to build the bomb. So if you're Iran, what are you going to do? Interestingly enough, the Iranians in Lebanon now, they come up through Syria, they actually have the high ground on this one mountain where they can look into the Mediterranean and down into Israel, and they can see sort of a lay of the land strategically, what is happening, where the Sixth Fleet is, all this stuff. So I believe that we might be looking at the Ezekiel 38-39 war, that Iran, instead of Israel, will make some sort of a preemptive attack. And in my book, I outline this. I believe it'll be a two-prong attack. They're just not going to hit Israel. They'll hit us simultaneously. At the exact same time they're hitting Israel, they'll be hitting us with 2 to 20 suitcase nukes, which are already embedded in the different cities in this country, which came up through the southern border, which has been documented in several books, which I refer to from my book. And I mean, you got to know where to look. But I forget the guy's name. I think it's Chirlin or Chirkov, right? Chirkov from our government, Homeland Security czar, it basically comes up saying, look, this is we believe that this may already been here this week. Listen, this is how crazy it is. This week I read this is from the Stratfor report, that the Iranians conducted this missile test. Well, what they were doing was they were, which was just bizarre, they were kind of like seeing how they weren't detonating the missile on the ground. They were detonating it like 100 miles up or 50 miles up. And it's like, what the heck are they doing that for? And then somebody said, well, this is what they could do. The Iranians can get a bomb, a nuke, okay, take a barge, take an ocean lining barge, right? Stick the missile on the barge, get within, let's say, 15, 20 miles of New York City, launch the missile, and detonate it 100 miles over the East Coast, 100 miles, 50 miles up in the air, right? Detonate it up there. What happens is it's electromagnetic pulse wave, which would completely disable every life as we know it would come to a stinking standstill. That'd be it. And then they would sink the ship, so there's no retaliation because no one knows where it came from. This was this week in the Stratford Report. This is the kind of powder kegs we're sitting on here, folks. And yet our government, well, not so much our government, but that because if I say that, people will go, yeah, I'm unpatriotic. Excuse me, guys. Look what the news we get. Look at the garbage and the pablum we're served up on Fox News and everything else. We're shown Lindsay Lohan, Paris Hilton, the antics of O.J., Amy Winehouse, and the list is endless. Whatever we can to distract the people from what is going on. Here are some things, which is why I believe that we're in this prophetic time. Jesus himself says that when you see wars and rumors of wars, famine and pestilence in various lands, and you know that the birth pangs, this is the beginning of the end. There are almost 14 million people in Africa right now who are facing starvation. The elections in Zimbabwe are an absolute joke, and what happened over there is just crazy, the carnage and the killing. There's still genocide happening in Darfur, where Christians are being slaughtered, and black Muslims are being slaughtered as inferiors, selective genocide again by their Arab brothers in Islam, supposedly. The Middle East is a powder keg ready to blow at any moment, and we can see that. So this is what we're into.
Well, I think this is what we're into, that's for sure. But the strange thing is that I also see that the human being has great promise for solving problems if we want to. We have at our disposal all the technology available today to get off the gas pipeline business, to move into such technologies as compressed air cars, electric cars, different kind of hybrids. I'm sure that there's all kinds of future use of technology for generating electricity. And after all, it's the energy part that we seem to be so concerned of. But you're also right when you think about it. There is some kind of nasty force or group of people or whatever that seem to be holding us back from that leap into a much safer environment to live in and a much more pleasant environment to live in and without the threat of war over our heads. But this agenda that's going on right now is kind of almost trying to prevent that from happening. And that's what I think you're saying in your book. And I can see that. There's a war right now between people that want to take advantage of the technology and clean up things and people that just want to continue to gouge everybody's pockets as far as they can go. So we're probably going to see fairly soon what's going to happen over that. Well, that brings me to a very difficult question, but, you know, we have free will. We were born with free will. We were born with the ability to look at things, make decisions, to choose the right way if we are conscious of it. And my question to you is, does prophecy have to come true according to the Bible, or is it not possible that we can wake up and turn the tide and not have these horrible things happen? It seems to me that we should be able to do that. But I'd like your feelings on it.
Well, I'm asked that a lot, and my answer to that is that because the prophecies have been written thousands of years ago, and by the way, there's no new ones, it begs the question, who or what agency is outside our space-time continuum and somehow giving this information to selected people. So very select few prophets get this stuff, and have them write it down. And it's in my opinion that, and I'm asked this a lot. Like I said, it's like, you know, can we stop it? Is there any way? And what I believe is that this deity, the supreme being, who is outside our space-time continuum, who is benevolent, by the way, who's good, who is benevolent, can see all points in the time-space continuum simultaneously, can access one or all simultaneously, and all he's doing is reporting events based on our free will. So when he talks about the Ezekiel War of 38 and 39, he's reporting what has already happened because he's already there, because he's dwelling out, because time for him doesn't exist. It's just a property for us. But because he's outside of it, the future, in essence, has already happened. And so he's seeing, he's just reporting back what has already happened. And, of course, you know.
Well, I think we're getting into a really, really interesting philosophical and metaphysical concept, because so what you're saying really is that yes, we have free will, but the prophets of old were actually seeing into their future at that time, which is our present right now. So in other words, we don't have free will according to their prophecies, but we have free will according to the momentary things that we do from day to day. That's a pretty far out concept.
Yeah, we perceive it as a time being linear, but in essence, time is not linear. An example of this, which is really easy illustration, we have TiVo. So you go out for dinner that night because it's your wife's anniversary, it's your anniversary, and you know you have to, but you're going to miss Monday Night Football and you really want to see the game. But you can't. You can't have both ways, right? You know, you got to go out for your anniversary. That's cool. I got TiVo. Make sure I don't keep the radio on so I don't know who wins, right? And I record the game. So I come back. Now it's Tuesday night, and I flip TiVo on, and I watch the game. But the game's already happened, all right? The game's already happened. So the guy on Tuesday watching the game, you know, is watching something that's already happened in the time-space continuum, it's been recorded, and now he can look at it and see it a day later. For him, it's just happening now because he's looking at it. He doesn't know. He has no idea that it's, you know, it could be 10 years ago. Obviously, he knows because he's the one who recorded it, but you get my point. He's viewing it for the first time, even though the game happened, you know, hours or days ago. So I think and that's an illustration of the way our time-space continuum is.
Well, it sounds either way is that we're already in the middle of one heck of a big ride. The powers of the Earth are extremely well-armed. There are other forces, as Dr. Marzulli has brought up in his book, Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural. And there are dark forces that are acting on people. Perhaps they don't even know that. And so it's probably a good idea to listen and make some kind of preparation for possible major wars around the world. And they may be coming very soon.
And on top of that, getting back to when we first started talking about the alien gospel and the presence of the Nephilim, Jesus himself says, in my opinion, one of the most enigmatic scriptures, and that is that when the Son of Man returns, speaking of his second coming, when the Son of Man returns, it will be like the days of Noah, which begs the question, what differentiates the days of Noah than any other time in history? And in my opinion, it is the presence of the fallen angels, which and their byproduct or their offspring in the film. And that is precisely, in my opinion, what we are seeing today. We are seeing the resurgence, the return of the Nephilim on the planet Earth. It's mirroring the days of Noah, and we're in those days again. Yeah, it's reaching a point of no return, and I think we're getting rapidly closing in on that. I think the things to look for is a simultaneous attack in the Middle East against Israel and on the shores of this country, the United States, unfortunately.
Well, I want to thank Dr. Lynn Marzulli, the author of Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural, to come on Authors Audio today, and we've certainly gotten into a lot of different subjects that I'm sure many people may not have thought about or may not have been up to date on. And so it's been my great pleasure to have you on, Lynn.
I appreciate that, Jake, and thank you for all your listeners and who listen to this, and I hope they walk away being a little bit more informed than they were at the offset of the interview.
And I just say to my listeners, until next time, keep dreaming and happy reading. This is Jake D. Steele. See you next time.